Okay, so let us get started with this evening's questions and see where it all takes us. Dear Ajahn, what are the qualities of the Dhammanusari and Sadhanusari we met up? Okay, so in the Buddhist teachings we have this idea of people who are noble ones, and the noble ones, they are the ones who have seen the Dhamma through insight. So they actually know by personal experience what the Dhamma is all about. Yeah, these are the noble ones, the Aryas. And the very first two of these Aryas, they are the ones who are just before you become a stream enter, you become a Dhammanusari and Sadhanusari. And if you become either of these, you are, it is said that you are guaranteed to become a stream enter before you die, when you die at the very latest. So their qualities are basically that they have faith in the Dhamma, in the Buddhist teachings. They have seen it to a very large extent, not perhaps quite as deeply as the stream enter, but essentially they have seen the teachings as well, not fully. I think that what is the distinction again between the Dhammanusari and Sadhanusari? I think the distinction is that Sadhanusari, Dhammanusari, they don't take anything in the world. If you ask them, is there a self in the five aggregates or in consciousness or whatever, they will know that there is no self there. But they haven't yet made the leap that this is a universal principle that applies to all phenomena. Something like that. It is very close to being a stream enter, but not quite there. So they are like stream enterers. And their confidence in the Dhamma and the Buddha, Dhamma Sangha, would be roughly the same as a stream mentor as well. The distinction is very small, and you are guaranteed to become a stream mentor in this lifetime. It says, I think it says somewhere, this is from the commentary, this is not from the suttas. It's quite rare that I quote from the commentaries, but here you are. It says in one of the commentaries that if the universe is about to collapse, and everything, the whole universe is about to kind of, because the universe is supposed to go, expand and contract, and you have certain times when the whole universe collapses. If there is a Sadhanusari or Dhammanusari who have not yet become a stream enter, then the universe has to wait with its collapsing until this person becomes a stream enter, because it has to happen in that lifetime. This is commentarial thing here. So it's kind of, it's interesting. So it really means you have to become a stream enter before you die. That's kind of the idea there. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for another delightful day of suttas. I don't understand this. When the Buddha practiced with Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, he attained the basis of nothingness and neither perception nor non-perception. Are those not deep states of samadhi or arupa jhanas? So why was the apple tree recollection of the jhanas, the rose apple tree collection of the jhanas, so significant? Thank you again. And that's a good point, and it's one of those conundrums in the suttas that there isn't any absolutely final answer to that question. There is a couple of possible answers, and I was touching on those when I was talking about this before today. And one of the questions is always, were these states that he achieved at that time, were they really arupa jhanas? In other words, immaterial attainments. That's what they're called in the sutta. They're called immaterial attainments. It is possible that they were not. And one of the hints that there may not have been that is precisely that what I was saying yesterday about in the Chinese Agamas, the parallel sutta to this sutta does not say that the bodhisattva was in possession of the samadhi. Yeah, it had three. He had three characters. He had saddha, he had energy, and he had panya. But mindfulness and samadhi, that was not mentioned there. Which is quite fascinating. Why is that? And that could be an indication that these things that were called the base of nothingness or the plane of nothingness and the plane of neither perception, non-perception, were names that were used. And the Buddha then took those names and used them differently later on in his own system. It's a possibility. I don't know how likely it is. It's one way of looking at this. Another way of looking at this, which is more kind of mainstream, is that these were real immaterial attainments, but because they were conjoined with wrong view. Yeah, remember that he went to Alara Kalama Udakaramputa according to the Pali Sutta. He learned all the theory first. Yeah, it says that as far as lip recital was concerned, that I knew what these two teachers knew, and there were others who knew likewise. So there was a system in place. There was a philosophy that went with that meditation. And that philosophy would very likely have been a Brahmanical philosophy about an eternal God, an eternal self, Brahman and Atman being the same. So it was very strongly conjoined with wrong view. So when, because of that, they could not really form the foundation for the breakthrough to awakening, because Samma Samadhi is always the Samadhi that comes with right view. If you have wrong view, then you're going to draw the wrong conclusions from that Samadhi experience. So he needed to take a step back. He needed to kind of, you know, go away from that a little bit and then think back to the rose apple tree experience when he was a child. At that time, he didn't have any views. There was no kind of Brahmanical teaching that came with that view. It was just an experience, yeah? And that's why that experience, being free from those views, is likely to have been, possibly, was then more enabled the Bodhisattva to make that breakthrough and see things in a different way. Yeah, so those are two possible explanations of what the reason for that. But it is a little bit of a conundrum, and I don't think anyone is absolutely clear what actually is going on there and what is happening. Remember that, you know, the suttas are, because they are so ancient, small little falls in memory can have a large effect, and this can be hard to sometimes, you know, sometimes little things can kind of make it harder to make out exactly what happened at that time. I don't think it makes much difference as far as the overall idea of the teachings are concerned, but it is an interesting little point. So, yes, very good. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmawali, when I start to do meditation, I never feel successful because in my mind, what comes up is a picture of daily routines. What do I have to do to do the meditation right? Even I have to start with relaxation? Thank you. Yes, this is very common. Yeah, the daily things come up in your meditation practice. It's very hard to avoid that entirely. And this is why, you know, when you become a stream mentor and you understand what the Dhamma is all about, meditation becomes automatic. Yeah? Because then you know your priorities. You have your priorities right. Prior to that, we're kind of trying to juggle these two slightly contradictory worlds. The world of our ordinary life and then our spiritual life when you come here. And it's hard to integrate those two things completely. As long as we have worldly attachments, we will tend to think about those worldly things to some extent. So this is why I encourage you to kind of try to reprioritize. Remember what is really important in life. What is really important in life is actually what we're doing here. This is where you can touch, if you get it right, the very meaning of life itself through meditation practice. You will never find that in ordinary worldly activities. This is far more powerful, far more meaningful. Once you start to get that, once you start to get the feeling of what meditation can do for you, and once you start to understand the limitations of ordinary life, we were just reading the Arya Pariyasana Sutta today, where the Bodhisattva is very clear. Why are we searching? When we already have the problem, we're going to die and get old. We search for all these other things that are going to die and get old as well. Yeah? When you think about that, it's actually quite shocking. It's almost like, wow, that's a good point. Why are we doing this? And once these things start to penetrate, this is why right view is so important, because gradually you are aligning your view of the world with the way the world actually works. Usually there's cross-purposes. The world works in one way. We think about the world in a different way. That's going to be problematic. We're not really doing things. As long as you think differently of the world from what it is, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to do things that are not going to be conducive to your benefit and to your happiness. So you have to get the priorities right. This is it. This is what life really ultimately is about. This is where you find out the purpose of existence. This is where you find true peace and contentment. Daily life is an internal process that has no end to it. You've been doing the things that you're doing in this life a million times before. Yeah, every million times before, it seemed just as important as it seems in this life. Every time before, you had the same attachment to your family members. Now they're gone, a million times over. Where's it all gone? It's gone. And yet now, it still seems so important. Can you start to see where this is leading? It leads you to become a bit more, have a bit more distance to these things. You start to understand that it's good to withdraw a little bit. There is a problem there. Then you withdraw, your priorities start to change. Your mind is more interested in things that have to do with the Dhamma, with the spiritual life, with meditation, with living well, and all of these kind of things. It's all about how we look at the world, how we think about it. The Dhamma is an entirely new way of thinking about things. It's turning things upside down. Where we thought, the things we thought were happiness, we understand, actually are problematic. The things we may have thought were suffering, actually, maybe they turn out to be really happy. Peace, nothingness, just sitting on your bottom doing nothing, being lazy. Wow, actually, it's pretty pretty good. Yeah? So this is the thing about turning things upside down, seeing things in a new way. It's one of the things about meditation practice. Sometimes, you know, one of the things that I find is interesting is how metta practice is practiced differently in different versions of the canon. You have the Visuddhimagga method, you have the Sutta method. The Visuddhimagga focuses more on individual people. The way that Buddha talks about metta, of course, it's a higher kind of metta, but the way he talks about it, as I mentioned yesterday, is about sending metta to the four directions, the four quarters, if you like. And it's not really sent to anyone in particular, just to anyone who is out there. It's very kind of universal. And the advantage with that is that if you do it to individuals, we always have some history with individuals. So either it can bring up maybe, sometimes if it is a difficult person, it can maybe bring up some negative feelings in which the metta meditation is not going to work at all. But sometimes if we do it to people who are too close to us, it can be conjoined with some degree of attachment. Yeah? And this is, again, this can again be problematic. It means that your meditation may stop at a certain point. So sometimes it's preferable to universalize that meditation. Just do it to the directions. Remember, there are so many good people in this world. Yeah, this is kind of the marvelous thing about the world. There's so many different kinds of people. Some are not so good, true enough. But there's lots of kindness out there. There's also lots of invisible beings in the world that have develop kindness to a very, very high degree, who are very pure-minded. They are also out there in the northern direction. Just visualize that in your mind. Remember what these qualities actually mean. What does it mean to be truly generous? It's a very beautiful feeling when your heart kind of opens up to everyone and you want to be generous to everybody. It's very powerful. There are lots of people and beings out there like that. Yeah, they are really worthy of our well-wishing. So just look to the northern direction. Think about all those beings out there. Wish them well. Yeah, what a wonderful thing it is to share the universe with you, to share this world with you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being Kalyanamitta. Then you do this to all the directions, and that will include all your relatives anyway. Yeah, include yourself. You also include it. You don't have to send metta towards yourself, because if you send it to everyone, you are part of that. You're part of everyone else. So it becomes universal. There's less attachment there, less clinging. It becomes a universal feeling. Yeah? So changing one's priorities is really the critical thing here. Yeah? Another reason why the picture of the daily life routines always comes up in the mind is because sometimes your meditation isn't all that much fun. Yeah, you sit there, it's kind of not really coming together, it seems a bit boring or whatever, and then the mind loses interest and it goes to anything else which seems important. Yeah, so this is why the attitude, being able to develop a bit of joy and happiness on this path is so important, because that is the glue, it is the attraction, the magnet that draws you towards that. Because everybody wants happiness, your mind is automatically drawn towards happiness. So if happiness arises, you will stick to the breath, you will stick to whatever is there. It's not going to go anywhere else. You will enjoy it. So have the right attitude. wow, so nice to be here. Such a marvelous place. You know, what a wonderful thing to have this opportunity here. 9 days every year you have this opportunity, or maybe a few times a year you have this opportunity here. But still, it is quite rare. Yeah, still it is quite different. How long are you going to have this opportunity? Is it going to come back next year? Who knows what's going to happen next year? Maybe a bushfire comes through and burns down the whole meditation center here. Yeah? It could happen, yeah. I mean, if you look at kind of the bushfires in Australia, it certainly could happen. And we're kind of living in the middle of a bushfire-prone area. So surely it can happen. So don't take it for granted. We just don't know what's going to happen next year. Now you have this marvelous opportunity here. Another way of thinking about it is maybe this is it. Yeah, tomorrow night I'm hoping to do a death contemplation. I didn't do it tonight because there was one person who wanted to be here who couldn't make it. So imagine if you are going to die. Yeah, maybe you're never going to make it back home again to do these routines. And you spend all the time thinking about it. Yeah, that's a waste of time, isn't it? So this is just, actually, it is a very realistic way of thinking, because what usually happens is that we tend to die in the middle of doing stuff. We haven't finished yet. There's more things to be done. And then we die still thinking about all of the things we're supposed to do. Yeah, you can see how silly it is. Yeah, we're just moving on, more and more things. And then in the middle of all that, we die. And we kind of die and then we get reborn. And we're already running with all these projects. We carry on in the next life. Before we know it, a million lives have passed. Yeah, and we're just running along, doing the same thing all the time. It's useless. It's not going to get you anywhere. That is not where meaning is found. It's just this eternal treadmill, never getting anywhere. Come back to the present moment. Now is the opportunity. Enjoy this, yeah? It is such a marvelous place, this Jhana Grove. It's very hard to find a place quite like this. Very difficult to find company like this. Very difficult to find these wonderful teachings of the Buddha. Very rare in the world. This is like, this is it, yeah? It doesn't get any better than this, basically. Yeah, except maybe sitting in your kuti, maybe even sometimes even slightly better again. But, you know, this is pretty much it. Think like this. Gradually move towards that. Of course, one of the things that you will also understand as you do this, if your mind tends to go back to your worldly activities and things, to be able to bring more happiness into the present moment, that happiness in a very large part comes from how you live your life. How can you live your life even better? How can you be even more kind to the people around you? How can you think more kind thoughts? Yeah, this is the groundwork, the scaffolding, the foundation upon which all meditation, all mindfulness, all samadhi is built. Sila, habits, character, who you are, this is really where it's all at. So ask yourself, can you be even more kind? Yeah, I'm sure this. We all have the potential to be even more kind. Yeah, it's very difficult to reach the pinnacle of kindness. So we always have more potential there. Remember, avoid doing the bad. Also do the good. Think thoughts of kindness. Yeah, there's almost an endless amount of work that you can do on those things. If you do that, then you are building up. Next time you come on the retreat, you will think less about all the ordinary things in life. Why? Because you're just much more happy to be here. So, try all of that. Please do start off by relaxing. That is certainly the right thing. Yeah, start off by relaxing and just kind of really, and because that is part of enjoy. If you are relaxed, you enjoy more, right? Yeah, it's just natural. If you don't relax, it's not as enjoyable to be here. So start with that and bring all of these things together. I hope I'm making a little bit of sense, but this is how, what I'm going to say. So anyway, so try again tomorrow if you're not happy with the answer here, or you want to ask more here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I was wondering if the Bodhisattva practiced Atta Kilamatana Yoga. Excuse my spelling, please. That's pretty good, actually. I have to admit, that is pretty impressive. I don't know. Yeah, so that's very, very good. There's only one spelling mistake. There's one letter missing, and you should merge the two words, and then you are in business. So very, very close. if the Bodhisattva practiced Atta Kilamatana Yoga following another teacher. Okay, so previous teachers, Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, obviously did not recommend it in their teachings with much metta. This was a very standard thing in India at that time. You know, the Jains were already around, and the Jains were into very severe ascetic practices, self-torment, self-torture, all of these kind of things. They are talked about in the Buddhist suttas. They obviously existed already, it seems, when the Buddha came around. So this was a kind of very common theme, the idea of torturing yourself, very much part of the Indian culture and how they did things. So it is possible that he had some Jain teachers, perhaps. Yeah, some of his practices are a little bit Jain-like. It is also possible that it was such a well-known thing in those days that the kind of there were standard practices. Maybe you didn't need so much of a teacher to do those practices. I don't know, but the teacher are not really mentioned there. So I suspect it was just kind of well known, and it was just you don't really have to have much of a teacher to tell you, okay, eat a small amount of food. It's kind of obvious, isn't it? Stop breathing. Okay. Yeah. So it's I think those practices are fairly simple, but getting into samadhi and practicing deep samadhi is much more tricky, and that is where having a teacher actually comes in much more handy. Yeah. Okay, dear Ajahn, thank you for your teaching. Number one, for other religions that do not believe in rebirth, what happens to the people after they die? Aha, okay. So if you don't believe in rebirth, then do you get reborn? That would be very handy. If you don't believe in rebirth, it means you don't get reborn. That means you make an end of suffering. Wait a minute. Somehow it seems too easy. Yeah. No. The problem is. Yeah. The problem really is that the point of the Buddhist suttas really is to point out to universal truths. What the Buddha claims to have discovered are universal truths. So when the Buddha claims that there is rebirth, he claims that that is a reality of how the universe operates. It doesn't matter if you. If you believe in rebirth or not, this has to do with how the universe actually is and how the universe works. And that is really the point. Is if you believe in rebirth or not, actually, is completely irrelevant. Of course, one of the interesting questions might then be, how does that affect your rebirth? If you don't believe it, does it affect your rebirth? The most important thing on what affects our rebirth is how we live our lives. So if you live your life well, whether you believe in rebirth or not is not such an important part. Yeah? If you have a very bad wrong view and then you practice accordingly, then your wrong view will have a bad effect on you. But if you have a kind of a wrong view that is a little bit bad, but you still believe in living well, it's not going to have a big impact on you. So that's another universal law that the Buddha discovered, the idea of karma. Act well, live well, and you get good results. And you see that right here, right now. If you are kind to other people, how do you feel about yourself? You feel good about yourself? Most people do, if you are kind. If you do something not so kind, how do you feel? You feel a bit rotten about yourself afterwards. Yeah. So you see how karma operates right now in the present moment. And then if you lift yourself up by doing good actions and good activities, that uplift that carries on into the future life, because you have built a beautiful mind for yourself, and bang, it carries on into the future. So how we live is what is the most important. If you are a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist, or you worship one of my ancestor gods, Thor or something like that, what happens? Now, imagine that you worship Thor, but you still practice metta. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? Okay, leave Thor out of the question. But certainly with Christianity, it is conceivable that you might practice metta. Yeah, you're a Christian or you are a Muslim or whatever. You practice metta. What happens? Well, if you practice metta to jhana level, you're also going to get reborn in the jhana realms. Yeah, because it's karma vipaka that matters. And this is the beautiful things about the Buddhist teachings. They purport, at least, the point is that they are universal teachings. They are an insight into the reality of the universe. They are not kind of just bound to Buddhism. They are supposed to be universal. So that is the point of it. At least at the levels of deep insight, I mean, there are maybe certain aspects of Buddhism which obviously are just Buddhist, but in terms of insight and understanding, yeah, it is about universal truth. So. Okay, number two. In Buddhist philosophy, human beings exist outside this world, in the galaxy. Do human beings exist outside this world in the galaxy? The universe has no end, infinity. What is the Buddhist view on this? Okay, this is interesting, and I gave a talk on this a few years ago at the Dhammaloka Center. You can look it up online. And I said some things that were a bit controversial. I got really told off by people afterwards. Not many, a few people kind of, what are you talking about? This superstition and that kind of stuff. But actually, the interesting thing is that in the sutta, sometimes the Buddha talks about the universe. One of the very interesting points about this is that the universe he talks about, he doesn't talk about the universe for philosophical reasons, yeah? Not what I might call natural philosophy, not to just to kind of explain the universe, how it works. That's not the point of the Buddha. It doesn't work like that. It's always in the context of a larger teaching. And that larger teaching is usually the teaching of impermanence, things being unreliable. So when he talks about the universe in this way, in this large context, sometimes he talks about other planets, other solar systems. And he says that these solar systems, he says, first of all, there's our solar system, yeah? The way he talks about that is the sun, the moon, and the planet Earth, and then all the beings that kind of exist in dependence on that. He doesn't say anything about other planets, because probably they didn't know about those, but he talks about that. And then he says, this is one system, one world system, Loka Dhatu, it's called. But then he says, there is 1,000 times those world systems out there. Then there's 1,000 times the second power of those world systems out there. There's 1,000 times the third power of those world systems out there. So in other words, he's saying there's like a billion solar systems out there with beings and things and everything else attached to them. So basically, he's saying that the galaxy is full of people, full of animals, full of ghosts, full of devas, full of everything, everywhere. Yeah, that's what he seems to be saying. And it is possible, I don't know whether he talked about, whether this also includes other galaxies as well. Maybe it does. It seems to me, from the way the Buddha speaks, that the universe is teeming with life. There's life everywhere. Yeah, and this is kind of really quite cool, isn't it? And that is where science is kind of gradually taking us as well. We're looking for kind of habitable planets out there. Yeah, we're kind of looking at the kind of spectrum of light to kind of figure out what kind of atmosphere they have and all these kind of things. So we kind of gradually seem to be moving in the same direction. Anyway, so that is what I would call the Buddhist view on that. Okay, then the last question. Wow, this is a really different question again. You're really using this chance well, aren't you? Could you please repeat the 5 ways of overcoming negative thinking? Thank you. I will talk more about how to overcome negative thinking as we get deeper into this retreat. I'm not sure, I can't remember when it's going to happen, but fairly not too far away, like maybe tomorrow or probably more like Thursday or Friday. And I will talk about this in detail. But very briefly, I will just briefly, because it's good to repeat these things, because they actually are very important things. And the first one, a first method, is the method of, which is sometimes called substitution. So this is the method. Let's say that you have a person, and you have a negative thought about somebody, but then you know that this person also has many good qualities. So you learn to focus on the good qualities in that person. You make that big. You make that something big in your mind. You focus on it again and again and again until it is so clear that this other person has so many good qualities. Like everyone here, for example, it's very easy to focus on the good qualities of people here. Everybody keeping the 8 precepts, everybody wanting to develop themselves in the Dhamma. Wow, it's so wonderful. But still, people will irritate you, regardless of how good they are. If the Buddha was here, he would irritate you, because that's just the way things work. But you remember the big picture, and then quickly you bring yourself back into balance again. That's how it works. So when that little kind of negative thought comes up, you bring back the memory of all the good qualities and you focus on that instead. And then that little thing just kind of evaporates because it's so insignificant compared to the good, great, large, good picture. So this is the first way. It's called like the way of substitution, because you're using one way of looking at a person to counteract another way. The second method is to remember the danger in that thought. When you have negative thoughts, it leads to all kinds of problems. Down the line, it leads to relationship problems with that person, because when you think badly, eventually you're going to say something bad. You end up saying bad things, you do bad things, you're making bad karma. If you don't check your anger and ill will, it tends to get out of control. And it tends to kind of snowball and get worse and worse and worse down the line. These defilements are actually very dangerous, because if we don't control them, they will have a life of their own and they will kind of take off on their own. Now is the opportunity to overcome these defilements. If you don't take the opportunity now, chances are you won't get that opportunity again in a long time. Now is the opportunity. Please take it. Now is a chance to overcome the negative states of mind. Please take the opportunity now, because this really is the only opportunity. Don't think that the other opportunity will come again tomorrow. You just don't know. It is so uncertain. Now is the chance. It really is urgent. Next life, is there going to be any Buddhism around? Where are you going to be reborn? Everything is so incredibly uncertain. Now is the only opportunity. These things are really dangerous. That is how you think. And when you think like that, and you can't just think it, you actually have to believe it. It has to be heartfelt. If it's just a superficial thought, it's not going to work. Then you can counteract it. Oh, don't want to go there. That's terrible. Forget about it. A third way is to forget about the thought. You are sitting in meditation and you see a little bit of kind of ill will suddenly drop coming up out of nowhere, not supposed to be there. So you just kind of ignore it and go back to the breath. And then if the ill will is not very established in your mind, it will just disappear by itself. Once it is established in your mind, it's very hard to get rid of it. The fourth way is the way of withdrawing the thought formation, the sankhara, the will behind the thinking. And that just means basically sitting there with the thought and kind of allowing the thought to die down, not feeding it, just observing it, being with it. And the more powerful your mindfulness is, the more quickly the thought will just collapse into nothing. And the fifth way is where you clench your you press the tongue against the roof of your mouth, you clench your teeth, you go like this, and you get rid of that thought that way. So don't do that one. Do the other ones and then see what happens. I'll get back to this later on. It's actually a very important part of the Buddhist practice, this idea how to deal with our minds, and overcome that the kind of thinking which is unwholesome. Very, very important. Such a powerful way to help the meditation, to make it easier, to be kind and virtuous. So it has an incredible amount of side effects and beneficial effects to it. Dear Ajahn, I heard during Buddha's period so many lay people attained arahat state by listening to Dhamma only. How can you explain this? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Many lay people attained arahat state. I'm not sure about arahat. That is probably asking too much, because usually if you become an arahat, then either it's on your deathbed, and then you become arahat, bang, and you die afterwards because you're on the deathbed already. Remember, the deathbed is often a good time to attain things, because you are giving up. You know that you're letting go. I'm going to die. If you are on your deathbed, you're dying. You know that you're going to have to leave this place. You have no choice to let go anymore. The reason why it's hard for us to let go is because we still think we have a future in this world. But you don't have a future in this world. This is the problem. The future isn't really there. So let go of that future. Then it's like you're on your deathbed. Then it actually starts to come home that you have to let go. So deathbed is therefore a good time to become an arahat. And then you die afterwards. Alternatively, if you do become an arahat as a lay person, the moment you become an arahat, you're not a lay person anymore. some of the stories in the suttas is that some people, they had so much merit, it says, that the moment they become arahants, the lay clothes disappeared, the hair got shaved, and they had monastic robes, just like bang, like that, happened automatically. I'm not sure about those stories, to be honest, but those are the stories, because they accumulated merit. But the moment you become an arahant, you are no longer a lay person. You cannot live as a lay person anymore. They say the fetter of being a householder has gone. You can live, you cannot store up things, you cannot kind of live in an ordinary way anymore, because it just goes completely against the grain. You can't hold on to things, you're not interesting, all these possessions and houses and all of that. You just, you know, you want to have a very simple and easy life. So in your heart and in reality, you are already, in a sense, a monastic, someone who has gone forth the moment you become an arahat, because your attitude has just changed so much. But it is true, there are some stories in the suttas about lay people becoming stream enterers, yeah, sotapannas, sovans, becoming even anagama. Sovan is the Sri Lankan Sinhala word for sotapanna, that is saying it. I think this is from a person with Sri Lankan background. I think, I'm not sure, so just in case, I thought I might mention sovan. Or anagamis, even non-returners. There are some lay people in the suttas who became non-returners. There is a lay person called Chitta in the suttas, another one called Ugga. There is Nandamata, she's a female lay disciple who was an anagami. So there are a few disciples like that. But first of all, they were very rare. Yeah, of course, they had practiced to get there. They often had practiced the jhanas and all of these kind of things. So they were very exceptional individuals who had these qualities. Stream mentors too, they were still obviously quite rare, but they did exist at that time among the lay people. One of the curious things about the suttas, it seems sometimes like you become a stream enterer quite easily. Yeah, the way it is presented, the Buddha gives a discourse and the person becomes a stream enterer afterwards. That is often how it is explained. But remember what the suttas give you. They give you often the kind of the crowning moment, yeah, after a long period of practice or whatever, and they give you that kind of final moment when you become a stream enterer. They don't tell you all the background or the backstory of what you had to do to actually get there. So, and very often these are narratives. They're not actual suttas where the Buddha talks and tells a sutta. They're often narratives. They're just stories, in other words. Yeah, and these stories have been told by someone else, not by the people who were there. So they're not as reliable as the actual suttas spoken by the Buddha. So there is some uncertainty there. But you are quite right. It is quite nice, though, isn't it, that lay people became stream mentors at that time. It means it can be done. Yeah, it should be an encouragement for everyone. These things are attainable if you are committed enough and you are persevering enough. But it takes a lot of commitment. Yeah, this is kind of the problem. A lot of perseverance to be able to do these kind of things. That is really the hardest part in the Buddhism, the commitment and the perseverance that is required to get there. Okay. Panta, you're doing an excellent job expanding the Dhamma. Please keep it up. Okay, thank you very much. Kindly elaborate your statement earlier regarding the four jhanas equaling the four stages of awakening, as in first jhana equals stream entry, second jhana once returning, etc. Please clarify. No, that is not really what I meant. It's not that they are the same. What I meant is just that they are on a same level almost in terms of spiritual attainment, in the sense that they have many of the characteristics are very much the same. Yeah, the degree of peace, the degree of happiness, not insight so much, but even the degree of insight is kind of similar. You know, the danger and sensual pleasures and all of that. There's a lot of qualities in common. There are distinct states, distinct things, but the qualities are very similar. So my point was more to say that the jhanas are very high spiritual attainments. They're not easy. And this is one of the ways we decide how to actually interpret them, to decide whether you have attained the jhana or not. If you have a little bit of pitisukha in your meditation practice, that's wonderful. You're already enjoying yourself, but please don't jump to the conclusion that it is a jhana state. What people often do, there is a sutta which talks about the five jhana factors, the five things that are present in jhana, vitakka, vichara. That's already very controversial what that means, but I say it means the slight residue of the movement of the mind in the first jhana. Then vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha. Yeah, piti, sukha is happiness. It comes in many different levels. So if you think that it just means ordinary happiness, then you will see first jhana very easily early on. Last one is ekagata, which means like one-pointedness of mind or unity of mind or something like that. Again, this comes in many different degrees and levels. So because these are five factors and they can be interpreted in different ways, people come to vastly different conclusions about what jhanas actually are. So because of that, sometimes you have to step back a little bit and look at the larger picture. The jhanas actually are almost tantamount to awakening. Yeah, you're getting very, very close to the end of the path. You're starting to experience those things that are almost identical to the awakening experiences. In the Chulahati Padovama Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 27, the shorter discourse of the elephant's footprint, the Buddha says that when you come to the jhanas, these are the footprints of the Buddha. Yeah, it's like you are standing where the Buddha stood. You are very close to the Buddha when you get to the jhanas. That is how important they are. These are marks of the Buddha. This is where Buddhas go. These are footprints of the Buddha. And of course, also the four stages of awakening are also footprints of the Buddha. This is how powerful they are. Yeah, so these are not small things. When the Buddha explains the path of meditation, you always have a large, long sequence of happiness before you get to samadhi, before you get to the jhanas. First of all, pamudra, the gladness, then piti, joy, then tranquility, then sukha, and only then do you get samadhi. So it's a long sequence of happinesses that go deeper and deeper and deeper before you actually get to the real samadhi and the jhanas. So remember that, this is not ordinary happiness. It's a particular kind of happiness that you get. It's called the vivekaja, vivekaja piti sukha. Vivekaja means born of seclusion. Seclusion from what? The five senses and the five hindrances. That's why I mentioned that yesterday. So I hope that clarifies the matter here. Okay, dear Adan, number one, is it possible that not all the devas are misleading? Perhaps some have listened to the Buddha's teachings in the past, still practicing and protect the people who practice the path. Indeed, that's a good point. I didn't really mean to imply that they all are misleading. In fact, I think that, one of the nice things about being reborn in the Devaloka is precisely that a lot of Aryas will also have been reborn there, So if you get reborn at this, you have to search a lot on among humanity to find Aryas. It's very rare and far, depending on a little bit on which country you are born in. Some countries the density of Aryas is a little bit higher in some countries. In other countries it's a bit lower. But generally speaking, the density of Aryas is very small, very 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 low density here. So in Devaloka, on the other hand, density of Aryas may be probably much higher. So it's not bad to be reborn as a deva. Sometimes people think being reborn as a deva is bad because you can't practice the Dhamma properly. But actually, you read the suttas and you have devas becoming stream mentors, devas becoming all kind of things. So I think that, being reborn in that realm, I don't think it necessarily is a bad thing. And you get some really good companions. According to one of the suttas in the heavenly realm of the 33, the boss up there, he's a stream mentor. The boss is a stream mentor. It's not some of the crazy leaders we have today. It would be nice to have some stream mentors out there to lead the world instead. Thank you for mentioning that. Number two, sometimes when I feel fear, I mentally chant the triple gem, Itibiso Bhagava, etc., etc. By the time when I finished, my fear usually goes away. Is there any reason for that? I don't know exactly how you chant it or what. One of the reasons why the fear goes away is probably because you take your mind off the thing that gives rise to fear. Why do you become fearful? You become fearful because you are focusing something in a certain way. And by focusing on something else instead, you're taking away your focus on that object. So the fear disappears. This is the most obvious reason, yeah? Why the fear goes away? Because you're just focusing on something else. Another reason is that sometimes when we focus on the Dhamma, if you have some idea what it means, yeah? The meaning of the Buddha, Itipiso, Bhagava. I just talked about it the other day, almost for 1 hour, just that little phrase. It's actually very beautiful. Yeah, the Buddha is out there. He taught this marvelous Dhamma towards happiness, how to move away from suffering. Once you understand that, you understand that you are actually on the path to happiness. Fear is about seeing danger in the future. Yeah, you're seeing suffering in the future. Itipiso Bhagava is about seeing happiness in the future, because you know you are on the path to happiness. So it gives you a different perspective on what is going on in your life. You are heading towards happiness if you are on the Buddhist path. Yeah, and that kind of lifts you up if you get that. So if that is what you get out of, if you understand the meaning of these words, Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno, etc. Try to get some feeling for those words, and maybe the chanting will become even more powerful as a consequence. So that those are the main reasons, I think, why that might work. So if it works, but the most important thing is that it works for you. Yeah, if it works for you, please do it. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, number one, it looks like there is not so many questions, yeah, but each one has about two or three sub-questions. So okay, when I read the suttas, I feel inspired. Great, that is wonderful, that is already a good step in the right direction, because not everyone feels inspired. It takes a certain ability to read the suttas in the right way to feel inspired by it. But also a bit of despair, okay, that comes the downside, and depressed that there are so many good qualities to develop and I don't know where to start. Well, you are here, so I would say you certainly know where to start, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Moreover, this annoying non-self thing means I can't use willpower like I used to. If I stop controlling, the habits, defilements come back to get me more easily. Please advise. Okay, so that's good. You're definitely getting somewhere there, because you're starting to see things more clearly. It's a very good question. The question is certainly shows that you are thinking in the right way. So that's great. So where you start with the most basic things, yeah? So many good qualities to develop and you don't know where to start. You start with the basics. How are you acting in your daily life? Are you, first of all, acting according to the 5 precepts? I think it's quite likely you are, otherwise you wouldn't be here. If you're not, please follow the 5 precepts. It will be a very powerful support for your meditation practice. Then ask yourself, how is the rest of your conduct in daily life? How do you act towards other people? Just go with the activities first of all. And remember, simple things like little acts of kindness in daily life go a long way. Little things that you can do for others is very often very beautiful. And you can often touch other people's hearts just by showing little acts of kindness in ordinary life. So what are your actions like? What is your speech like? Most people find that being kind in speech all the time is very hard. But actually, speech is a wonderful opportunity to give gifts to people almost all the time. If you speak kindly, if you speak nicely, if you say things that are useful for others, then that actually is a wonderful gift to give to people almost at any stage. And what a wonderful thing it is to be able to give gifts to people all the time, to be generous. Yeah, you don't actually have to buy anything. All you can do is open your mouth and say the right thing. It's a wonderful thing. So look at that. But lastly, and most importantly, look at your mental qualities. And I will talk more about this later on. How we can learn to see the people around us in such a way that we can have metta, or at least compassion for them. Where if you can't have compassion, at the very least, we can have a neutral feeling about them. And this is where it really starts to bite and really starts to work. But I will talk more about that later on. So That is where you start. Just gradually start to kind of unroll this ball of thread that is the Dhamma and start in one end and gradually move. And willpower, like I used to, yes, you can't use willpower like you used to. And this is kind of another important point. The point is that there are better ways than willpower. And those better ways are called wisdom powers. As Brahm's word, wisdom power. You learn to investigate. You learn to look at what is going on. You learn to reflect in a different way. And I will teach you how the Buddha teaches this later on. Yeah, the Buddha has very specific ways of thinking about things that enable you to kind of let go of these particular defilements. So learn to think differently. Learn to perceive people in a new way. Learn to see them with new eyes. It's not that hard to do. Everybody can do this. It's just a matter of training and persevering, and you will eventually get there. But it's a very good question. Why can't I use willpower? Well, actually, willpower isn't very useful. It's very weak. It's very... it doesn't take you very far. Wisdom, far more powerful. Yeah, so the defilements come back, and we will, hopefully, you will be a bit wiser about this when we come to the end of the retreat. Question number two. Say I have wrong view and I practice with a wrong intention, etc., like some of the Jains, but don't some of them hear one teaching and get to stream entry here? So if you suddenly switch to right view, then okay, Okay, let me try to figure out exactly what you're saying here. So practice with the wrong intent, like some of the Jains, but don't some of them hear one teaching and then get to stream entry? Okay, so It depends on many things. It depends on the kind of wrong view you have. Yeah, it depends on how. I mean, what exactly is that wrong view? It depends on how it affects your conduct and all of these kind of things. It's complicated. But if you have a very strong wrong view, it is very often very difficult to take you away from that wrong view because it's very strong, it's very entrenched. Yeah, and that is part of the problem. But let's say that you have a wrong view that is not very serious. Let's say that you are a Jain ascetic, yeah, and you and you believe that kind of by torturing the body you get rid of all karma. But basically, you are a really good person and you practice really well in the world. And then the Buddha comes along and says, actually, this asceticism you're doing doesn't really work. Think about it this way, and you think, yeah, you have a point. Actually, it doesn't really work. And then you switch your view over. But because you have all those other good qualities underneath. Yeah, then you can make fast progress after all. So some of these people, for example, they would have gone forth in other religions because there was no Buddhism around. The Buddha hadn't really arisen yet. And then when the Buddha came out with his message, they would have switched over. But because they were already very purified, because they were already very good people, they would make very fast progress. A classic example is Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana. They were disciples of an ascetic called Sanchaya Belatiputta, or something like that. And he was a skeptic. And they were part of the skeptic religion, yeah, because it was before the Buddha came around, and they had this kind of agreement between each other that if one of them found a good teacher who was special, who had attained awakening, he would tell the other one. And then one day, when the Sariputta, this is the story, yeah, it's probably likely to be just the story, it may not be the full truth, but there may be something to that. One day, when the Sariputta, he goes into the city to ask for alms, yeah, he was an ascetic, not a Buddhist, but some other ascetic, and on his alms round, he sees this monk. And this monk is Venerable Venerable Asaji. And Venerable Asaji is one of the first five disciples of the Buddha. So he sees this monk and he says, wow, there is something about this person that is very confidence-inspiring. The way he walks, the way he talks, or the way he doesn't talk, rather, and the way he kind of carries himself. Yeah. And this is what they say. If you meet an arahant in the world, just seeing an arahant is a massive benefit because you see something else. You see another possibility. It opens up a view of reality that is different from what you're used to. Just seeing one person who has some spiritual attainments can be incredibly powerful. And this is exactly what happened to Venerable Sariputta. So he goes up to him and says to him, something like, you're very inspiring. Who is your teacher? And then he says, well, my teacher is the Buddha. What is his teaching? And then Venerable Asaji, who was already a stream mentor, arahant or whatever, he says, well, actually, I'm very new to this teaching. I don't really know much about it. Yeah, he's an arahant. and so then he gives him this very simple teaching about anything that is subject to arising is also subject to passing away. Yeah, that's the whole teaching he gives him. And based on that, Venerable Sariputta becomes a stream mentor here. Yeah, this is the story. Whether it was as fast as that, whether that is a contracted version, may very well be, but it gives you some idea of how these things happen. Yeah, someone is very ready, very clear. They've done the right practice beforehand. But then there will be other ascetics who have not been doing the right practice, who have very strong, very wrong view, and then it is very difficult to. So we are so complicated. There are so many different angles by which we come to the Dhamma that complicates matters so much that it's impossible to make any general statements as to how far we're supposed to progress or anything like that. So even if some people switch to right view, they get it straight away. Other people switch to right view. It still takes them many lifetimes before they get there. Question number 3. In Majjhima Nikaya 26, the Buddha said he didn't just want to rebirth in the Arupa realm. So the idea that a state of samadhi leads to corresponding rebirth was already known to the bodhisattva. I would never have thought of that. Is it an already accepted common idea at that time? Or the Buddha was just so smart? Thank you. We met Angarit. Well, again, I'm not entirely sure, as I said before, whether it really refers to those Arupa realms or not. But the general idea, you are right, the idea that it seems the Buddha had an understanding that if you attain certain samadhi, you will be reborn in a corresponding realm or corresponding plane. He seems to have had that idea to some extent already. And I think it's just kind of, in many ways, it's common sense, yeah? Common sense that you develop your mind to a certain level or a certain degree, and that is where you continue when you pass away. That's really all it means, yeah? So if you develop your mind consistently to Arupa realms or some other mental state of samadhi, and you die at that point in where you are, then that is where you continue. Yeah? It's kind of just, this is how karma works. And so he just obviously must have had some insight into that, as you say. He already had that enough intelligence or whatever to kind of make that judgment at that particular point. It is also possible that that was part of the Brahmanical teaching at that time. Remember, the Brahmanical teaching in those days was about attaining samadhi and attaining unity with Brahma as a consequence. Yes, the samadhi state would be roughly equivalent to that unity with Brahma afterwards. So it was, I think, also a generally accepted idea, which may have been part of the teachings of Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta as well. So he may actually have got it from there as well. A technical question, Ajahn. Sometimes the Buddha gave Dhamma talks in front of over 1,000 disciples. How could those people who were seated in the back row hear the Buddha's voice without loudspeakers and such? Okay, so yes, it's a good question. Okay, let me just look at the next one as well. Or were there some means to transmit his teachings, like a group of leaders might sit close to the Buddha and later share what they've heard to their group members? I don't really know the answer to that, but you have a point. Sometimes, even now there's only 60 people here or something, and still we use the microphones. Yeah, so it's kind of a good question. I think one of the answers to that is that the crowd sizes are very unreliable. Yeah, there are examples in the suttas where the Buddha taught 20,000 people. Yeah, this is actually in the Vinaya Pitaka, and these numbers are very inflated and do not actually reflect any reality of what happened. These are like stories, like narratives. So I think one of the reasons is simply that it's very uncertain whether the Buddha actually ever taught crowds that size. Yeah, maybe he taught 100 people, maybe 200 people. 200 people, you could probably quite easily, everybody could hear, especially if they sit in a circle. Yeah, you'd have to be a bit more compact than you are now. You have each have a lot of space around you, which is nice. It's important to have that, but you have a bit more compact. You come close to the teacher. Yeah, you sit very close together. Yeah? So that is probably how it would work. Yeah? And then you probably have some point about this, that there would be, then the teachings would be passed on later on, yeah, to other groups. So they wouldn't necessarily come together in very, very large assemblies, because it would simply be, it would be impractical. But there are some suttas that say that if you are a Buddha, you can make your voice heard in the thousandfold world system. Yeah, that's what it says. So you can teach the thousandfold world system at the same time, and your voice can be heard over the whole thing. So if, let's say, okay, so if a thousandfold world system, actually, you could, apparently, get it heard over the thousandfold world system to the third power, a billionfold world system. So if in each world system there is a billion people, that's a billion times a billion, yeah? You can teach a billion times a billion people in one go. Now that's pretty impressive. And that is by projecting your voice in a kind of, in a supernatural way, and you do that. And then you can teach a billion. What is the number? Is that a billion times a billion? It's a lot anyway. Yeah, it's a lot. Let's just say it's a lot. Yeah, you can teach a lot in one go if you have that kind of supernormal powers. So maybe we should try to develop that. Then that would be interesting, wouldn't it? That would be really. Anyway, no need anymore because we have the internet. Internet does the job. That makes it easier. Okay. Usually light nimitta doesn't last long, only a few minutes. So one can't rely on it to take it to jhana, can you? What would you suggest? Okay, well, if you are getting in light nimitta already, what a wonderful thing that is. Yeah, you should be so happy that you're getting the light nimitta. And well done. So it does not last only a few minutes. It is true, but that is because you are still developing it. Yeah, this is only the beginning, and you have to keep on developing it. All of these things are very uncertain in the beginning. They last a short period of time, and as you develop it, it becomes brighter, more stable, and eventually it can take you all the way to jhana by developing these things. So keep on doing it. Keep on purifying your virtue at the same time. Often your virtue will be reflected in the purity of your nimitta. The better your virtue is, the more kind you are to the world around you, the more pure, the more bright your nimitta will be. Yeah? Isn't that interesting? Why? Because the nimitta, or the light in the mind, is a reflection of your mind. Pure mind, pure nimitta. So just keep on going. Yeah, enjoy what you have already. And as you do this, it will develop. And one day, hopefully, you will also be able to get all the way to a jhana experience. When the nimitta comes, one of the first things to remember is not to kind of do anything. Yeah, if you start doing things at that point, you will lose it. So when the nimitta comes, just enjoy the experience. Focus on the, Ajahn Brahm always says, focus on the most beautiful part of the nimitta. Why? Because that is the most attractive thing. That is also the most beautiful part in you. So it will encourage you to see the piti in sukha, and it will build up the good qualities as a consequence. So focus on the most beautiful part, the brightest part. Don't do anything, just be a passenger. Yeah, this is very crucial at this point. And if you can do that, then hopefully you will be able to sustain it longer next time around. So see if that works and see what happens. Dear Ajahn, if citta arises and citta passes away, how does memory work? The way memory works is because of association. Yeah, so if I say to you, your mother to you, then you straight away get an association. You think about your mum because I mentioned your mother. Yeah, it works through association. So the mind is always changing. You can actually see that the mind is changing, yeah? Changing all the time. It's very obvious in a sense. So you see that. And then every time the mind changes to something else, then that brings up another association. So you're thinking about something else. And association after association, this is part of what actually keeps the mind running, this associative process moving on. So it works through association, always change and association working together. How can we have past life memories? Well, it's a similar, same thing again. It's through association. Yeah, very often in this case, you direct the mind deliberately to remembering things. If I say to you, remember what you did this morning, you can do that. What did you do yesterday? Yeah. What did you do a year ago? You have some idea what you did. And if you develop this systematically, you can memorize things systematically going back in time, including your past lives. Yeah, it's a systematic bringing things back. If you can remember things in this life, there's no different from remembering things this life to remembering things in past life. The same principles really apply here. How can these Dhamma teaching memories influence, help us in future lives? Thank you with metta. How can these Dhamma teaching memories influence, help us? Well, the way that that works is that, and this is also actually in the sutta about this too, and the idea is that you lay you implant a seed in your mind. That seed is the Dhamma. Yeah. So the more you understand the teachings, the more powerful that seed is already inside of you. And in the next life, when you hear something which is similar, somebody said, "Oh, have you checked out this teaching? This spiritual person called the Buddha who existed a long time ago. You want to check out this?" You think, "The Buddha? Wait a minute. There's something familiar about that." Yeah. It's association again. You associate because you have heard about the Buddha in the past. And then the memory re-arises quite easily. When you read the sutras, you think, jeepers, there's something familiar about this. You have this deja vu experience, yeah? You feel a bit kind of, your hair stands on end. You wonder, what? This is weird. Yeah, these similes or whatever, and all of these things. So you have built in a seed inside of you that then grows and starts to come back to life when you hear the teaching in future life. The same thing if you get reborn as a deva. You get reborn in Devaloka, the other deva start to recite the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, and then you think, oh, I've heard this somewhere else before, and it comes back to life again. This is how it works. But it's more powerful the more you have practiced. Because the more you have practiced, the more clear your mind is. Yeah, then it's easy to remember all these teachings. Also, you have an advantage because you have already done a lot of the work. You don't have to, so it makes it easier to carry on in the next life because you already have laid down the foundations in this very life. This is the two ways it helps. Lay down the foundations now to assist you in your future lives and help you lay down that memory which then comes back again, springs back again in future lives. Dear Ajahn, was the pursuit of release from old age, sickness and death unique to the Buddha, or was it common among ascetics of his time? Could it be that he had started with looking for the way to immortality and later found the truth? What is neither perception nor non-perception? Was it common at that time? And I suppose in many ways it was common. I don't know if it was common. The pursuit of spiritual paths was quite common. Yeah, people understand that life is unsatisfactory, that there are problems. We all understand that. That's why we are here. Yeah, this is what we're doing here. We understand that there are problems to overcome. Life is not always wonderful, and we can always do with a bit more happiness in our lives, a bit more equanimity, and a bit less suffering and problems. Everybody would like to do that. So for some people, that would have been concerned with old age, sickness and death, it would have been different takes of what was required. But the Buddha seemed to have been particularly clear-eyed about this and a particularly understanding on how to actually overcome this. Yeah, some of these other teachings, they lead to the exact opposite. Some of these other teachings are really scary. You know, if you look at some of these ancient teachers and the kind of philosophies they had, you think, jeepers, how can anyone say these things? They're literally scary, saying that there's no bad karma by slaughtering other beings and this kind of stuff. If people start to act on that, you know, it's terrible. So, in one sense, the idea might have been to make come out of suffering, but also it was completely misguided at the same time. So yes, I think in a sense there is some truth to that, but also it is a lot of it was also very misguided at the same time. Could it be that he started looking for a way to immortality and later found the truth? Well, I don't think so, because the Buddha never says anything about it. He doesn't say anything. He says that, you know, he starts out seeing the problem in death. Yeah? Okay, there's a problem here. And I want to resolve this particular problem. So what is it that he's looking for? Well, he's seeking for liberation from death. That is what he's seeking for. Yeah, to me that is kind of the obvious conclusion. If you have this problem, you want to resolve it. Well, that's how you resolve it, by finding an end to that. Immortality is an additional thing beyond finding liberation from the suffering that you have seen. It's something more. It's not really what. So you look for the most basic thing and then see what happens. And neither perception nor non-perception is just a particular meditative attainment. In the suttas, you have the kind of the meditation attainments being the four dhanas, yeah, the basic, it's not really basic at all, very high levels of samadhi, and beyond that you have what is called the four immaterial attainments. And of those four immaterial attainments, the final one of those is called the base or the realm or the plane of neither perception or non-perception. So it's a very, very refined kind of mental state that is possible to develop if you take it in that direction. Okay. Ajahn, how to deal with sensory desire towards the opposite gender? Why does it arise? Okay. So how to deal with why it arises? It is because when you look at the opposite gender, you find the opposite gender attractive. That's why it arises. As simple as that. When you see the beauty in something, whatever it is, whether it's food or whether it is entertainment or it is the opposite gender or it is the same gender for that matter, yeah? If you are gay or whatever, then of course it's different, yeah? So whatever it is, wherever you find something that you are attracted to, that is where desire arises. It's as simple as that. So you have to kind of reprogram your mind a little bit. So how to deal with sensory desire towards the opposite gender? Well, you have to understand that real contentment is found in meditation practice, yeah? And if you are too attracted to the opposite gender, you end up getting married and all these kind of things, you're going to lose that opportunity to practice this path in the same way. The more entangled you are in worldly things, the less possibility there is to do spiritual pursuits. Yes, this is one way of thinking about that. Of course, not everybody is ready to become monastics, so it is possible to also combine, you know, ordinary life, if you like, with spiritual life to some extent. You can do that as well. So I'm not saying that you have to go one way or the other. But generally speaking, what I recommend people to focus on, rather than focusing too much on sensory desire, which actually is quite difficult to overcome. The Buddha says so in the suttas. It's quite hard. It takes a lot of persistence and perseverance to overcome that. Focus instead on the ill will, because that gives far more immediate results that are so, useful straight away. And that is much more of a blockage to your meditation than sensory desire. And as I was saying yesterday, if you reduce the ill will, you actually also reduce the sensory desire at the same time. Because a lot of the problem with ill will is that it feels very bad, and then you want to kind of escape from that bad feeling, and that is where you're attracted to, sensual pleasures as a consequence. So remember the limits of relationships. Remember the problems that relationships are. Remember that even if you get into a really good relationship, one day you're going to have to die, or your partner is going to have to die. Yeah, imagine having the perfect relationship, and then it's going to have to be over. Regardless, you can't really win. And this is why the death contemplation is so powerful. When death is always there, you can't win. There's always going to be a problem. And the relationships just add to the problem. You are going to die already. Big enough problem. Don't add more to it. That's what the Buddha basically was saying in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. Okay. Last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teachings. May I ask, what are the five hindrances and how do we tackle those? Okay, so the five hindrances in brief are sensual desire, number one. I just talked very briefly just now about how to tackle those, and we'll talk about it a little bit more later on. Second one is ill will. I've already talked a bit about how to overcome that, and that too I will talk about later on. The three last ones are restlessness and remorse. Yeah, you're fidgeting, restless, you can't sit there. In part, that often comes because you have some remorse about the past, some regret about something. How is that overcome? Well, it's overcome by living well. And it's also overcome in large part by removing the first two hindrances. The first two hindrances are a powerful source for the last three hindrances. If you remove the first two hindrances, all five tend to disappear as a consequence. Yeah, if you have sensory desire, you become restless because you are looking towards satisfaction somewhere else. Ill will also leads to restlessness. The fourth hindrance is tiredness and lethargy. Yeah, there's many reasons for that. One is you haven't slept enough. So if you feel really tired, go and have a nap and see what happens. Other reasons for tiredness is if you have ill will, for example. Ill will, very often you feel tired afterwards. So again, by reducing the first two hindrances, sensual desire and ill will, you're also reducing tiredness and lethargy at the same time. The last one is doubt. And doubt is about one's ability to understand what is truly wholesome and what is truly unwholesome in the world. And this is one of the reasons why you study the suttas of the Buddha, the word of the Buddha. This is one of the reasons why I tell you to investigate your meditation after you meditate. That is the time to have some insight into what is going on in your mind. Look back on your meditation. See what happened. Yeah? And then you start to understand which things are wholesome, which are unwholesome. You start to see what the clear mind is like. You start to understand what a mind free of defilements is like. And as you do that, you start to understand this whole process, all the problems that are there. That is what the last hindrance is about. So those are the five hindrances. And I will talk more about these later on, especially the first two, because they are by far the two most important ones. Emptiness, what does it actually mean? What it means is that something is missing. Yeah? So I can say, now this basket is here, so in my perception there is a basket. Now my perception is empty of a basket. Yeah? If something is missing, that's what it means. Something isn't there. Now that emptiness can be taken to many, many levels. If you close your eyes, I'm empty of visual input. That's already a calming thing because visual input has such a powerful impact on us. And one of the great things about meditation is to empty out as much as possible, simplifying the content of our minds. One way of looking at that is to say, call it emptiness. Another way that I mentioned before is to, almost like the khandhas are slowly fading away. It's another way of thinking about it. Yeah? The more empty you are inside, the less things there's going on, the nicer, the better you feel about yourself. The easier, the more happy you tend to be as a consequence. So that is the idea of emptiness. It's a lack of things. Things being taken away. That's what it means. The final emptiness in the suttas, the one that really matters the most, is to see the emptiness of the self. Yeah? The main problem that we have is that we experience the world as if we have a sense of, as if there is a self there. But the Buddha says that's a delusion. And that delusion is what we're trying to overcome ultimately. So the ultimate idea with emptiness is to understand that that sense that we have is empty of reality. There is no reality behind the illusion of the self. It is just an illusion and nothing more. And once you see that, that is kind of descending into emptiness in a very deep way. Is it a teaching more of Tibetan Buddhism? It is more emphasized in Mahayana Buddhism, and they take the idea of emptiness much further. Yeah, they say everything is empty. They talk about, you know, all external things also being empty. But that is not really part of the early suttas. The early suttas, they focus on empty of a self and emptiness in your perceptual framework slowly gets emptied out. How do I relate emptiness in daily life? I am not sure if you need. I think the best way to relate emptiness in daily life is to be empty of bad conduct. Yeah. be empty of bad conduct. That's one of the best ways in daily life. So empty your life of bad conduct. If you're empty of bad conduct, you're doing really, really well. Don't really have to relate it so much to daily life, because emptiness is really very much about meditation practice, how to simplify things. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. But if you want to use it like that, if you are inspired by the term, you think it's nice, think about it like that. Empty out those things that are unwholesome and bad for the path. That is kind of a nice way of thinking about emptiness, perhaps. Okay, there you are. That's all the questions for tonight. So enjoy, have a nice night, have a nice rest, have a good rest and good sleep. And then we'll see you again tomorrow morning here.
Satsang with Mooji.